Welcome back to Coast AM. Dr. Michael E. Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics, the political study of the key actors, institutions, and processes associated with extraterrestrial life. Dr. Sala's books include Exopolitics, Political Implications of Extraterrestrial Presence, Exposing the U.S. Government Policies on Extraterrestrial Life, The Galactic Diplomacy, Getting to Yes with E.T., Kennedy's Last Stand, Eisenhower UFOs, MJ-12, and JFK's Assassination, and his most recent book, Insiders Reveal, Secret Space Programs and Extraterrestrial Alliances, in that he analyzes whistleblowers' testimonies revealing the extent of classified space programs and the extraterrestrial diplomacy. His website, of course, is exopolitics.org. I'd like to welcome back to Coast, Dr. Michael Sala. Michael, aloha, sir.
Aloha, Jamie. Glad to be here.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Now, it seems like you and I have been talking all week, and right now, there is such, especially over the last year, you've been doing exopolitics for a long time, but over the last year, the subject of whistleblowers, their testimony, their evidence, and the secret space program, it has certainly been on the front burner in ufology.
There's been quite a buzz just around the whole idea of secret space programs, but I think it's just the extent and the detail of the information that has emerged over the last 12 months that has really gotten people's attention. And I think people are really open to the possibility that there have been advanced anti-gravity vehicles that have been developed as far back as during the Second World War era, and that many of the UFOs that have been witnessed ever since may not be extraterrestrial in origin, as many people first thought, but they may in fact be very terrestrial technologies. And so people are very interested in that possibility, because when they look at the technological developments that go back all the way to the early part of the 1900s, then they see that it's very possible that some scientists developed these technologies, and that the governments that were willing to fund them secretly had programs where these technologies were used and developed and craft were built.
Well, for you, and certainly with your background, which I find fascinating, because you had a choice, Michael, to have a completely successful career unrelated to ET, the alien phenomenon, UFOs, and you took a left-hand turn, and you had an epiphany. What was that?
Well, that epiphany for me was watching Dr. Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project press conference back in May of 2001. At the time, I was a full-time academic teaching international politics at American University, and I was looking for answers to conflicts that were happening around the world, because that really was my specialty. I was a professor of international peace and conflict resolution, and so I was very interested in what is it that drives international conflict. So I was very open to alternative theories. And in fact, one of the courses I taught was called Theories of Conflict, Violence, and War. So I was very open to different theories about what is it that drives international conflict. And so when I watched Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project press conference, I was really amazed at the quality of the testimony, the sincerity of the witnesses, their willingness to come forward and stake their professional careers and reputations on the line that, what they experienced were real. And it really set me off on a journey to find out, well, just how credible are these ideas of a cover-up of extraterrestrial life and advanced technologies that are not being released. And as I went down that rabbit hole, I found just more and more answers to some of the questions I had developed over the years of teaching and researching and writing about international politics.
What is a whistleblower? Now, of course, we have Edward Snowden, and we have other whistleblowers throughout politics and commercial industry and so forth. But for our circle, for the alternative circle, and certainly the ufology type of circle. What is a whistleblower there?
Well, generally speaking, a whistleblower is a person who blows the whistle on some kind of wrongdoing, whether it's occurring in official government institutions, departments, or whether it's occurring within our corporations, or it might be occurring within educational institutions, schools and so forth. So a whistleblower is someone that basically just reveals something that is being covered up by an organization to which they belong. And when it comes to the whole disclosure issue, whistleblowers are basically revealing what they know about a cover-up of extraterrestrial life and advanced technologies that have been conducted, whether it's through government, whether it's through the military or corporations, and they have come forward and they've been doing it in greater and greater numbers. In the 1990s, many whistleblowers began coming forward towards the end, but in the early 2000s, especially with Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project, there was a flood of whistleblowers.
Is there, for you, is there a normal way that they approach you? And what do you use? Do you have a checklist that you go down to determine if somebody is, telling the truth? And how do you vet the sources?
Well, that's a really good question. I find every case is unique. People's circumstances are so different, especially whistleblowers. And so you just need to be aware of the unique circumstances that have brought them forward and to be able to ask them the right questions and vet them as best you can. Over the years, I've developed quite a database of different whistleblower testimonies, and so I'm able to kind of like cross-reference a lot of things that people say, and I'm able to kind of like get an idea of whether or not they're contriving something or whether they're just revealing some new information. Generally speaking, I've found that most people that come forward are very sincere, but that doesn't mean that they're being truthful, because you can be sincere and untruthful in the sense that, you may be part of a program and you may be programmed to reveal misleading information. I've also had cases of people who are telling me the truth, but yet if they get exposed, then they will kind of like backtrack. They want to keep their cover. So, all the cases are very unique, and one just has to really be prepared to, investigate someone's testimony for a long time if that's what's necessary to kind of find out just how much of what they're revealing is the truth. And of course, the more documents they share, that's always going to help. But often I find that, many whistleblowers don't have documents, and in some cases they don't even have personal documents confirming their kind of basic educational claims. So that's always a challenge, but, that's just part of this field.
Well, and we're going to discuss one of the latest whistleblowers that have come forward, and you and I have been talking about this. It's fascinating. But in this case, he has revealed his own identity. When you are talking with a whistleblower for the first time and they don't want to give you their name, of course, for us, the ones that want evidence, that's the first thing. You can't just call yourself a whistleblower without identifying yourself. Is that one of the first stages and when you are trying to vet somebody, is to get them to come forward and reveal who they really are?
Well, that's always one of the challenges as far as being a researcher or an investigator is, you're really wanting the information and you're wanting to confirm how accurate that information is. And the whistleblower's credibility, their background, that's all part of the kind of normal vetting of that information. But it's not necessary. It's not really required. It's not essential, because you're really after the information. If that whistleblower, for example, was involved in a black program, dealing with, say, the surveillance of extraterrestrial abductions, then, you know, you're very interested in any information that they have to share about that program. And if they reveal themselves, then that's going to help substantiate their their claims. But it's not really necessary to work out whether or not it's possible that there are secret government programs basically monitoring extraterrestrial abductions of private citizens.
Well, certainly if a whistleblower comes forward and he's got 1,000 documents and that is presented, you don't necessarily need his ID, and you don't need to run his background. But if somebody comes at you with the opposite, without documents, and all they have is a story, then you have to get their name, and then you have to vet their employment history and education just to make sure that they are who they say they are.
Well, that's right, yes. So when they just give you a story without any accompanying documents, then there's not that much substantiating their story. So then, yes, you do put more emphasis on them coming forward and revealing who they are. And, and I found one of the things that really helps is to be able to have video testimony of any whistleblower.
Right.
Because you can look at it and people can look at it. And body language is a very good sign as to whether or not people are telling the truth. And this is something that I've found very helpful in researching the Corey Good case.
That's right.
Because, when I first began to interview Corey, it was all by email. It was all basically, me writing him a series of questions and him answering back. And we kind of did that for a few months. And so I kind of got an idea of his entire story. And I really kind of got to get an idea of just how he thought, because in writing his answers to my questions, you've got kind of get to see how a person thinks as they respond. And then when the video interviews started coming out with David Wilcock on the Cosmic Disclosure series, I saw him answering many similar questions, but now he was on video. And it was very interesting, just to kind of compare his video testimony with his kind of testimony as it was revealed by email. It was his body language was very clear. There wasn't any sign of deception. But what I could really appreciate being a researcher was the fact that, his verbal testimony corresponded exactly with his written testimony. Because, when you write, and when you speak, you're using different parts of the brain. So, if a person is being deceitful in any way, you'd very quickly see major discrepancies between what they're writing and what they're saying, just because different parts of the brain are being utilized for those two skills. But it was very accurate, and so that just kind of helped me in my personal journey in vetting Corey Good, that, yes, he was someone telling the truth about things that he had directly experienced, seen, and read about during his space program service.
Well, it's one thing, especially in the case of Corey Good, when you come along and upset the world of alternative research, our world. And when I say upset, I mean, he literally rocked the boat. And you come forward with this, and then it's a whole other thing, Michael, for Corey to actually set foot in public and start to mingle and do presentations and answer questions directly so people could look into his eyes and see his demeanor. He's no longer somebody that's, hidden on the internet or behind a computer monitor and keyboard. He's actually a real person willing to face the music.
Well, that's right, yes. Everyone has kind of within them some ability to be able to kind of sense anyone trying to fool them. We all do things like, whether it's going to a car yard or going out on a date with someone, whether there's any kind of deception going on. We kind of get skilled in that. It's not foolproof, but we kind of develop a sixth sense in that. And the thing with Corey is that his story has taken off so much, because people can feel, or they can watch him, and they very quickly realize that this person is being completely genuine. There's no deception. And so then their attention shifts to the information. And as they kind of start to go through the information, you know, their mind starts to expand with the possibilities that, you know, all this can be true. And, you know, and what I've done with my research into Corey's testimony and the last book, Inside of the Real Secret Space Programs, is compare his testimony to the kind of historical documents and developments over the last 70 years or so, and found that there's a very close match, and that there's a lot of kind of circumstantial evidence as well supporting his testimony. So yes, I'm convinced that everything that he has revealed is exactly as he experienced it, and he's just relaying it to us. And for me, it's all a question now of like, well, who else has experienced similar things, and are there documents out there that can substantiate these kinds of incredible testimonies?
Which we will be talking about right after the break. You have just gotten back from San Diego interviewing the newest whistleblower to come forward with all of this and documents and everything else. We'll be talking about all of that right after the break with Dr. Michael Sala. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We are talking with Dr. Michael Sala. We've been talking about whistleblowers and the secret space program and ufology in general when it comes to whistleblowers. And it is such a very unique, touchy, personal situation. And Michael, you just got back from San Diego, where you got to sit down and converse and interview a whistleblower. Can you take us through that and tell us about the experience?
Sure. Well, this is a very important case because the whistleblower in question, he worked for U.S. Navy intelligence during the Second World War, and he heard things from Navy spies embedded within Nazi Germany who were working in the top aerospace corporations and Nazi SS programs dealing with their most advanced projects. So these Navy spies were reporting back to naval intelligence out of the Naval Air Station at San Diego. And William Tompkins, at the time, he was recruited into that program because of his extraordinary design skills. He had exceptional abilities in designing Navy ships, and because of that, he was recruited in to this top-secret program where he would sit in and hear these Navy spies give their debriefings to a Navy admiral and either one or two Navy captains, and revealing what they had seen in these Nazi programs. And based on what he heard, Tompkins' job was to then go and basically put together a package, an intelligence briefing package, based on the information that he had heard, and to then get on a plane and fly that package or packages to various aerospace industries or think tanks throughout the United States. And he did this over a four-year period. And in that four-year period, he says that he basically performed close to 1,200 of these missions, where he would go into these corporations such as Douglas Aircraft Corporation, Lockheed. He'd go into think tanks such as Caltech, MIT, many of the leading aerospace companies in the United States, and take these packages and basically give them these packages and say, well, you know, this package deals with this particular program that you have certain expertise in. You know, let's just say it's some kind of advanced aerospace program. You know, what can you do with this information? And the idea was that that way various U.S. industries would get to learn what the Germans were doing and see if this was something that could be replicated in the United States. So that was his job, and the really important thing about William Tompkins is that he actually has the documents to substantiate that he was actually doing precisely that mission, that work.
Take me through the process on that. Were you able to get employment verification and certainly his military records?
Yes, we got. Basically, there are records that he provided showing that he had a mission out of the U.S. Naval Air Station. So one of the documents, for example, was titled Statement of Mission Tasks and Objectives, and that's dated September 26, 1945, with his name on it and his U.S. Naval number. And basically it says that he was authorized to be a disseminator of naval aircraft research and design. So that's one of the documents that he provided. He also provided another set of documents that were basically travel slips that basically gave him authorization to enter and to leave the Naval Air Station there at San Diego, and to carry with him packages. So this is also another piece of documentation that he had supporting his testimony. Also, there are pictures of him back in 1941 when he was recruited by U.S. Navy intelligence. There are pictures of him with a U.S. Navy captain, and also quotes from a U.S. Navy lieutenant saying that Tompkins had exceptional abilities and that they would be of service to the Navy. So he has provided these documents substantiating quite definitively that he did actually work for the U.S. Navy from that period, 1941 to 1945, as a disseminator of technology, of aircraft designs. So this is really very important, because now we can kind of like, once we've substantiated that he actually did have that job, then it's like, well, what was the contents of the packages that he was delivering, and what was it that the Navy spies were telling the admiral and the captains and Tompkins at those debriefings?
Well, what were the Navy spies starting to reveal about the Nazi program?
Well, the information that they were revealing is really startling. You know, I may as well just kind of come out and say it right up front, because it's something that many people might find challenging. But basically, Tompkins said that these Navy spies, and by the way, he said that there were 28 of them, and they would come in on 6-month rotations. They'd come back to the U.S. on a 6-month after 6 months in Germany, they'd come, give a debriefing, and then they'd go back.
And this was from 1942 to 1945?
Correct, yes. What they said that they had seen and had direct experience with was that the Nazi SS, that there were actually several, at least two autonomous space programs that were being developed in Nazi Germany, and that one of the programs involved the Nazi SS, and another program involved German private citizens associated with secret societies. The Vril Society was the one that was mentioned. And they had facilities in Antarctica, and that they were in these Antarctic facilities, as well as underground locations throughout Germany, that they were building these very different types of anti-gravity craft, that the Navy spies said that the Germans had developed 30 different designs of various kinds of anti-gravity spacecraft, utilizing the kind of flying saucer design or a cigar-shaped design, where they would use some kind of propulsion system. Anti-gravity was one of those propulsion systems that was used.
Right.
And that this was something that was being developed in Europe and in Antarctica, and that they made great advances in those programs.
Was there any mention, I know they mentioned the Vril, but was there any mention of Thule?
The Thule, of course, was the kind of sponsor of the Nazi Party. I didn't actually ask Tompkins about the Thule Society because once he confirmed that the Thule Society was behind this, then that implied Thule Society participation, because the Thule Society provided the funding for the Thule Society. The Thule Society was a kind of metaphysical society that was kind of headed by these female psychics, and they came up with information that they gained through psychic means on how to build various spacecraft. And then the Thule Society provided the funding and the resources and the infrastructure to kind of go ahead and build that. So that happened in the 20s and the 30s. Then in 1933 and 34, the Nazis came to power, and they basically institutionalized what had been happening previously under the Thule Society and the Thule Society. So now basically the secret space programs that had been developed with prototypes in Germany during the 1920s and early 1930s had now been put under the rubric of the Nazi Party. But the Nazis continued to allow the civilian space program to move forward, but they also created a parallel program that was headed by the Nazi SS.
Yeah, and what's key here with these 28 informants for us with the Navy, and that being 1942 to 1945, there's a few other key dates with Tompkins here, and one of them was that date of 1947. And as he starts to communicate with, you know, Northrop and Lockheed and Douglas Aircraft and TRW, General Dynamics, that's another key date for 1947. And as you started to look at those documents, what popped into your mind, and what were you able to ask him about that date of 1947?
Well, there's kind of a couple of important dates in 47. You know, the one was the Operation High Jump out of involving Admiral Byrd, and that was a very significant event. People still don't kind of fully appreciate exactly what happened.
That's right.
Basically, what had happened was that a flotilla, a U.S. naval flotilla, had set sail for Antarctica to basically locate, take control, or to destroy any Nazi bases there. Now, the problem was that the Nazis, ever since they had built the bases in 1939 up until 1947 when Admiral Byrd's expedition finally arrived there, that basically they had close to 8 years of uninterrupted R&D into these anti-gravity technologies. And so by the time Byrd had arrived, the Nazis had very developed spacecraft using these technologies. And according to Tompkins, essentially what happened was that over a 48-hour period, there were two waves of flying saucers that just appeared out of the ocean. He said there were roughly 30 craft altogether in the two waves of flying saucers, and he said that all of the aircraft that were part of Operation High Jump were destroyed, and also a number of ships, including a destroyer and other support ships, were also destroyed. And then the rest of the fleet was allowed to return to kind of like send a message that the Navy shouldn't try anything similar to that again. Now, one of the things that is important to emphasize here is that the Nazis were being helped. And this is also one of the things that the Navy spies said that really shocked them, was that the Nazis had reached agreements with a reptilian extraterrestrial species, and that these reptilians were acting as consultants in the Nazi high-tech programs, and that the reptilians had basically steered the Nazis, or allowed the Nazis to go to had told them about three locations in Antarctica where the Nazi SS could build facilities for the secret space programs. So basically the Nazis throughout the Second World War and while they were in Antarctica were being helped by a reptilian extraterrestrial race.
And the other thing that we can't deny here. In 1947, not only Admiral Byrd and Operation High Jump and what occurred down there, but you had William Rhodes in Phoenix in July. You had Kenneth Arnold up in Tacoma. You had Roswell. And all of these specific sightings happened right in a row and weren't related to each other all the way down to Antarctica. It was a key year.
It was. And this is where we kind of get into the whole question of, well, exactly who was piloting those UFOs. I mean, the assumption that many UFO researchers have is that, well, these are non-terrestrial in origin because, there were no technologies that were being developed at the time. And there are various studies refer to a lack of knowledge of any kind of terrestrial technologies that could match the performance of these UFOs. So the Project Sign report that was developed in 1947 basically referred to early German research, but said that at the time that there was nothing in the U.S. Kind of aerospace industry that could match what those technologies were doing, and the closest analog was in Nazi Germany. So, there they were kind of referring to Germany as being, possibly linked in some way. But now, with this information from Tompkins as well as, Corey Good, that now we can kind of say that many of those flying saucer sightings in the 40s and 50s, we don't have to say all of them, but there would be a significant proportion of those that actually were related to these Nazi flying saucer technologies that had been developed from the during the war and had been kind of produced in large numbers in Antarctica. And then in the 1950s, basically there were a lot of overflights of major American cities, and I think some of those overflights really did involve Nazi UFOs pressuring the Truman and then the Eisenhower administration into secretly signing agreements that would allow the U.S. military-industrial complex to be infiltrated.
On your website, there's an illustration of this kilometer-long spacecraft design with the Navy, and that is something that will open up somebody's eyes. And Tompkins refers to that being designed, it's a kilometer long, back in the 50s and 60s, but they were eventually built and deployed by the United States Navy as space battle fleets in the 1980s. Is this starting to be evidence that is cross-referenced?
Well, yeah, there is a lot of cross-referencing in terms of the things that Corey Good and other whistleblowers have said in terms
exactly.
of their involvement.
Right.
Tompkins is unique because he actually did work for major aerospace industries throughout the 1940s, right through to the 1980s. And in the 1950s, he worked at Douglas Aircraft Corporation, and he was there from 1950 to 1963. And one of the documents that he showed me in San Diego was a document showing that his two superiors, a Dr. Klemperer and a Dr. Elmer Wheaton, he wasn't a doctor, both of those two individuals were involved in anti-gravity research. So there's a document saying that Tompkins' bosses were directly interested in anti-gravity research. And Tompkins' job there at Douglas was to design many different types of ships for the U.S. Navy to create a battle group in space. That the Navy wasn't interested in just building one ship or one or just several ships. It was like a whole group of ships that would be part of a battle fleet for space. So that began in the 1950s. Tompkins came up with these designs, and there are several documents that he's released with his designs. And basically, Later on, these designs were then taken to the next level of kind of like architectural plans, and that was Tompkins was involved with another company, TRW.
Well, let me jump in right there. We'll pick that up right after the break. And the drawings and the designs are absolutely fascinating. We are talking with Dr. Michael Sala. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be back more with Michael right after this short break. Stay with us.